everyone, and welcome to Palestine Exists, a space where we dive deep into all things Palestine, from history and politics to culture, resistance, and the stories that deserve to be told. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by the headlines, frustrated by misinformation, or just eager to learn more about Palestine beyond the mainstream narrative, this is going to be the place for you. Today's episode, we're going to do something a bit different. We're going to dive into the stories that actually matter, the voices that need to be heard, and the struggles that have shaped the Palestinian world. We're going to turn on our focus to a deeply emotional and significant moment, which will be the release of our Palestinian hostages. Every single one of the hostages has a story, and for years, they and their families have endured the pain of separation, the uncertainty of loved ones being imprisoned, and obviously the heavy toll of occupation. So again, today we're going to bring you the stories of resilience, hope, and the bittersweet reunions that follows years of waiting. And obviously we have Lina and Habuba here. How are you guys?
Hello, I'm
Hi,
good.
my loves.
Hi,
Hi.
baby.
Hi, babies.
I
This is
think
gonna
this is
be.
a re oh, sorry,
Sorry,
go.
no, I was gonna say this is gonna be a hard one.
It is. I think so too.
Well, this is definitely a tough topic because it's just like we're gonna go really into depth on what really drives a person living under occupation to do the things that they do, and not even just that, also the idea of the Israeli occupation taking any person and throwing them into prison as a further drive to resist said occupation.
Yeah, 100%. It's like the human side of this long-standing quote unquote conflict and what it truly means to the people who are living there, who are involved, and just the Palestinian struggle, whether it's in diaspora, whether it's inside of the occupied land.
100%.
Yeah, so today we're each going to talk about one of the hostages who have been released. It's going to be very informative, inshallah, and we're going to talk about not just the struggle that they had faced in prison, but what led to it, their families. A lot of the hostages have lost family members while they were inside of the prison too. So it's going to be a hard episode, but stay tuned. The first person we're going to talk about is Nael Al-Barghouthi. So just like a quick recap on Nael. One, he's Barghouthi is a very, very known name in Palestine. There's Marwan al-Barghouthi, there's Hanan al-Barghouthi, there's so many. They are distantly related. So Nael al-Barghouthi and Marwan al-Barghouthi are distant relatives, but not, immediate relatives. So he is the longest serving Palestinian political prisoner. He spent over 44 years inside of prison. A lot of people see him as a symbol of steadfastness and resistance against the occupation. And he was actually released today, February 27th. So he was released finally after 44 years. Unfortunately, though, with the occupation still having their dirty hands on our Palestinian people, he was unfortunately expelled from Palestine and is prevented from returning to the West Bank, to anywhere in Palestine. And he was exiled to Egypt. Yeah, so a bit about his early life. He was born October 27th, 1957, in a village called Kubur, near North Ramallah in the West Bank. He grew up in Kubur. He was attending primary school in the village. He continued his education in the Prince Hassan School. But his story and his family's story is actually very important. His family, like from the British Empire, they were always resistance fighters. His dad was actually detained by the British forces, and his uncle was un sorry killed during the I keep censoring myself because of TikTok, but his uncle was actually killed during the Great Arab Revolt in 1936. So a family of resistance fighters, I would say. At age 10, When he was 10, he witnessed the 1967 Israeli invasion of his village. Obviously, like every other person did as well in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And it's, as we all know, like this is one of the longest occupations in our history, not just our history, I believe in a while too. They say that his resistance against the occupation began the day he saw the army go into his village, and this is according to his sister Hanan al-Barghouti. So from a very young age, ever since he was 10, and he was seeing everything, seeing his mom be harassed by Israeli settlers. His mom's name is Farha. She was consistently harassed by the settlers, by the occupation forces. His family, again, they were known for resisting, whether it was the British Empire or the Zionist militias in the 1930s. So they were always a target for the Israelis. But he was involved in throwing stones at the Israeli tanks, like pretty much every other child. But I want to make sure people understand it's a child with Palestinian stones versus a military tank. That shouldn't be a crime. You know, you throwing a tank at your military occupier should not be a crime. And he also would paint anti-occupation slogans on walls everywhere. And obviously apartheid wall wasn't there then, but he would draw it everywhere. They would protest, him and his family would protest all the time as well. Yeah, that's a bit about his early childhood. His brother, whose name is Omar, and his cousin Fakhri, they were also very prominent in the resistance of just Palestine resistance. They were all arrested. All three of them were actually arrested when they targeted Israeli military forces in the 1970s. He was, oh, I'm sorry,
Safa,
Nael, sorry, you guys,
why are you
Nael was
sorry for
arrested.
coughing, girl? Come on.
Sorry, I get flustered. But yeah, Naen was arrested in December of 1977 for the very first time for throwing stones at Israeli tanks. He spent 3 months in those jails, and he was released. While he was released, mind you, he's, you know, a high schooler right now. He was released. He was preparing for his high school exams. And he, you know, wanted to succeed in his life and wanted to do something with going to college and doing what any high schooler would want to do. But unfortunately, in 1978, sorry, no, not 1978, he was arrested and yeah, while he was studying, like 5 months after his release, he was arrested again by Israeli forces and spent the next 34 years in jail. They never gave the story of why he was arrested that time. And they then went on and further imprisoned him and sentenced him to life in prison on charges of allegedly killing an Israeli officer alongside Umad and Fakhri, who were his brother and his cousin. So till this day, his lawyer came out and said he didn't do anything. It wasn't Nael, but because those three were always involved in something, because Umad and Fakhri were the ones who did it, they lumped him into it as well, which is very sad and is something that we see within a lot of Palestinian prisoners, just Palestinians in general. While he was in jail and when he, you know, came into jail, people saw him very high, like people saw him as a very highly person. They looked up to him, and he got the nickname for Dean of the Prisoners because of his popularity. Everyone loved him. He was an amazing person. He actually learned both Hebrew and English while he was behind bars. So in the prison, the other prisoners would say he has like a reputation as like an avid reader. He loved history. history, loved learning in general. And this is the cutest thing I've ever read. And it just shows like Palestinians how much their land means to them, and not just their land, their family and everything for them.
Right.
So yeah, while he was in prison, his mom would visit him every now and then, and he had a lemon in prison. So he took those lemon seeds and asked his mom to plant those seeds in their yard so he can always be connected to the land and to Palestine. And then every
Oh
other
my
visit
goodness.
after that, I know it's so cute. Every visit after that, he would also give her a water bottle and he would say, I want you to water it from the prison waters so this tree can also become resilient.
Oh my
Amazing. It's
goodness.
so cute.
That is
Yeah.
like the cutest thing ever and like the biggest symbol of like our people. Like that is us. Like that is our people. And
Yes. Like
his
Hiba
heart.
says something. Hiba, do you want to say it or do you want me to say it?
Just remind me.
Ever since you said this, it's been like something in my brain, like a tab open in my brain, remembering
Okay.
it. That we are the ones, it's basically along the lines, we're the ones who planted the seeds, and they water our
Oh, I
plants
said it.
with our
I said
blood.
it's no, essentially that like do you okay, so during the hostage release, actually the most recent one, they kind of no hinted to it. They said the land recognizes, what did they say? It was on the poster. Okay, right here. Okay, so essentially like during one of the, this was in February 22nd, they raised the banner that said, take off your shoes, for every inch of this land has been watered with the blood of the martyrs. Which is something that I've been saying for the last like couple years, and I say something along the lines of the land does not recognize you. The land needs like our land. This is why you need to hire like foreign nationals, like people who are familiar with the climate, in order to get them to tend their land. This is why we had to sit for weeks, months, years in the beginning, like during, you know, the during the like when people were coming to the land to teach them how to care and love and tend to the land. And our land needs to be tended with love and with water. And the land will never agree with them because our land has been watered with our blood, and it recognized that and it knows that, and it'll always reject them. So, yeah.
100%. Whenever I remember that when you say it, I get goosebumps because it's so true. Like it's 100% true. The land itself, you guys are watering it with our blood. It will always not acknowledge you. And when I read this about Nael giving the water from prison to build the tree's resilience, the seeds from the prison, so he can always have a connection to the land. Like Palestinians will go to the ends of earth to always connect to their land, whether it's in poetry, whether it's giving seeds of a lemon while you're in prison. And it just it's within us. Like this is how Palestinians are. And like even October 7th or Al-Aqsa flood, when they broke out of it, the first thing they did was kiss the soil because they have never seen the soil of Ascalon or Ashkelon. And it always breaks my heart when
Like
I
those
see it.
videos when they were like oh my God, those videos on the 7th when you just saw regular civilians, like not even like not the ones who like went into the to whatever. It was like just the ones who just breached to the gate and like they were just kissing the soil. Like
Yes,
the
yeah.
it was so symbolic and metaphoric. It breaks your heart.
It does because they're caged, and we hear people in the West Bank always say, like, I've been here, this is my land, I've never seen my land see. People in Gaza saying, this is my land, I can't even travel a mile away to look at where I was actually from. So yeah, this is, I always find this like as a part of resilience and resistance because there's multiple ways of resistance and we always talk about it. So this was like the epitome of what he did to me. Like, I don't know. I find it very, very cute and very Palestinian of him to do. But yeah, this was, it's like the epitome of Palestine to talk about or to give seeds to your mom to plant them into your land. But yeah, that's a bit about his mom. Also, while he was in prison, he was watching TV, a television report, and he saw a Palestinian woman named Iman Nafi, who was an advocate for Palestinian prisoners. But unfortunately, when he saw her, she was actually being arrested, in 1987 for conspiring to attack, Israel. And unfortunately, she spent over she was sentenced to 15 years. She spent only 10 years, which, alhamdulillah, she was released in 1997. But after he saw Iman, he just fell in love. And he asked his mom if, like, when she gets released, can you please go and propose to her from me? And Iman says when she heard this, she obviously said, yes, I would, I can get her the exact quote. She said, she obviously agreed to marry the Palestinian hero without any hesitation, when his mom went and asked for her hand. So they were technically engaged, but unfortunately, he was sentenced to prison, lifetime of prison, specifically 117 years, prison statement, and for his resistant activities. So they didn't know what would happen. They had no idea there would be any hostage exchanges or a deal. A bit more about him and his affiliations. He was part of Fatah before ever joining or going into prison. He was part of Fatah, the PLO. But then he saw everything going on with the PLO and he wanted to break away from it. He really resented the leadership, the PLO's leadership, specifically in Lebanon, and the failure to prevent the massacres of Palestinians and the Sabra Shatila massacre. So he was looking for a different group to join. He attempted to join the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, but he eventually just aligned himself with Fatah al-Intifada, which is technically a part of Fatah, but not really. It's a breakaway group that falls outside the fold of the PLO. And it wasn't specifically the PLO that he was upset about. It was just everything that happened during Lebanon, and he wanted to break away. So he went to Fatah and Intifada. And he's been a member ever since then. And then afterwards, Hamas emerged, the Hamas movement emerged, and he emerged and joined the Hamas movement, in the late 1980s, 1990s. While he was in prison, there was a prisoner deal from with Hamas and Israel during the Galot, I believe the Galot prisoner,
Oh, yeah.
In 2011. So after 34 years of being in Israeli detention, he was part of the hostage release, the hostage negotiations. He was released, but unfortunately, during his time in prison, both his parents died. His mom died in 2005. His dad died in 2004. So he was never able to go and attend their funerals, was never able to bid them farewell. His brother also died in 2021, and we'll talk about that a bit more, but because of COVID shouldn't have said that, but I'll continue. But when he was released the first time, he was fully released October 18th of 2011. And he was one of 1,047 Palestinian hostages who were released in 2011. He continued, he tried to continue with, normalcy after his prison escape or exchange. He fully married Iman. They officially got married a month after his release, and he went on to study history at Al-Quds Open University. According to Iman, Barghouti was they commemorated their marriage, and he said, another victory against prison, a challenge to those who deprived us of our freedom, and a triumph of the spirit of faith and hope. They did denied us freedom, but didn't kill our determination to break our chains. Now I can say that Iman and I will embark on a new journey as we are about to start yet another family in this great nation. And that was when he first was released, in 2011. So
Oh my
they, you
God.
know, yeah, they lived a very cute Palestinian like life. They were fellahin, so they were farmers. They farmed, tended to their crops and to their land. Unfortunately, he did remain under house arrest, so he couldn't really do much, but he tried to go back to college and study history. He tried to live with his wife. But unfortunately, on June 18th of 2014, Israeli forces did a crackdown on the West Bank, and it saw more than a dozen Palestinian prisoners who were released in 2011 taken back. During that time, he was sentenced to 30 months in prison. And we all know it wasn't just 30 months. He stayed in prison and continued until 2025. And what they said was, we are going to keep you here and we're going to reinstate your previous life sentence because of a secret file that they had. No one was able to see this file. The judge had no idea what the file is. His lawyer had no idea what this file is. They had nothing on him to continue holding him. And to finish his life imprisonment. His lawyer actually filed several appeals and petitions against this. Obviously, they were all denied from the military court. In 2023, Yehoram, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, they reported that Na'in's health had severely deteriorated in prison, and it continued to decline after he was transferred from Ofer Prison to Golubiah Prison. And he came out and he stated he endured severe beatings, severe abuse, severe torture, cigarette burns, just horrible all around. They had him in solitary confinement. And you guys just remember when he was rearrested in 2014, they only sentenced him for 30 months. That's it. For nothing. They didn't tell him
No.
why he was being rearrested, but because of the secret file that Israel, not only did they do this to Na'el, they've done it to multiple people. Well, they will either arrest them or rearrest them and state a secret thing that no one can see, not the defendant, not their lawyers, and yeah, khalas, you're in prison for life for that. But with this new hostage release, we got to see him finally being released from the torturous prisons that are Israeli prisons, military prisons, on February 27th of 2025. Unfortunately, though, he was exiled into Egypt. His wife, Iman, who barely had like 3 years with him when he was released. She is unable to go to Egypt and actually meet with him. They have banned her from traveling from the occupied West Bank. She is not able to reunite with him at all. And it's not just her, it's multiple other wives and family members, two Palestinian prisoners who were exiled out of their land. He will always remain as a symbol of resistance for all of the Palestinian people. And when he came out today, he stated the only way Palestine could ever be liberated is with unity and with the Arab states, the neighboring Arab states, to finally stand up and force the occupation to end. And I agree with him. I truly hope that him and Iman can find a way to continue their marriage, whatever is left with it. He is currently, let me just get the exact, he's 67 years old. So he spent 45 years of his life. He was arrested in his early 20s. So 45 years of his life, 67-year-old. He barely has any time left, especially with his health issues. So I truly hope him and Iman can figure a way out, and meet and just live, whatever life is left for them both.
Oh my God. That is like the most heartbreaking
I
but like
know.
heartwarming. I don't like I hope the same thing. I hope the exact same thing. It's
Yeah. And it's sad because he's not the only one, like spending years in prison. mom, dad, brother being
Yeah.
killed while he's there. They can't even bid farewell. They can't
Right.
even, grieve. I don't, you can't grieve when you're also being tortured.
Right.
So I wish them nothing but the best, inshallah, and to
And
continue the Palestinian resistance, even in exile.
yeah, 100%. And that's like a common theme in, I think, most of these prisoner stories. It's like their battle with the occupation is never ending. Like, we can't say that they've ever lived a life like absent of occupation, which I guess kind of leads me into speaking about our next prisoner who was taken, which is a man by the name of Zakaria Zubaydi. Essentially,
I
you
love
guys
him. I love him. I
like
love him. I love him. I love
guys
him.
guys this person, like, I feel like everyone kind of knows he they might not know his name, right? You might not know his name, but you probably will know his face and his story, and I will go deeper
Or just
into
like
it.
they just need one like just like yeah,
One
a spoon,
word, one
one
word.
word
The
and like one
spoon,
word
yes.
and
One
him
word, one
something and know
word.
who he is. The
Yes, this is
spoon.
the spoon. Like, everyone, I remember in 2021, everyone was well aware of this like iconic prison break, and this happens to be one of the six people who conducted a prison break with a spoon from one of the high security prisons in Israel. Yeah, I guess right now I'm gonna delve into his story a little bit deeper. Okay, so yes, we're gonna talk about Zakaria Zubaydi, which is perhaps known as the iconic prisoner of 2021 who made the major escape from the Israeli prison, Gilboa prison, with nothing but a spoon alongside him, his six other inmates. Essentially, I really want to delve into his childhood story to kind of like really help the people who are listening understand what it's like to be raised in occupation, be born into an occupation in a refugee camp. So Zakaria, like every other Palestinian child, was raised under Israel's belligerent control. His experience with the occupation was traumatic from the beginning. He actually grew up in the Jenin refugee camp, where his family had been displaced after the 1948 Nakba, alongside hundreds and thousands of other families. In his early years, they were like every other Palestinian, right? He experienced things like Israeli military raids, home demolitions, and being from Jenin specifically, as we all know, one of the most heavily targeted areas in the West Bank, we can all kind of imagine what it's like to be raised in such a condition. We can only imagine, if that makes sense. But essentially, he attended like the UNRWA schools because he is from a refugee camp, and he is a refugee, where he was described by all of his teachers to be a very bright student. But by the time he was just 13 years old, the occupation had already left a big mark on him. In 1989, he was shot in the leg by Israeli
At all.
military soldiers for just throwing stones, like literally just throwing stones. He's a 13-year-old child being faced with a belligerent occupation, doesn't really know how to react to it. And that was probably his first major traumatic experience, where he was shot in the leg. And then it required four surgeries to
Wow.
four surgeries at the age of 13.
Just from like, just from just getting shot.
Getting shot in the leg, but and not even just this, it left him with a permanent limp where his leg was actually one leg was shorter than the other.
Wow.
So
Haram to
it's
experience that at 13,
at
wallah.
13, like I start to like imagine it. I have like everyone has someone close to them within this age group. Like, we were all 13 at one point.
Girl, I was listening to Taylor Swift, Teardrops on My Guitar, when I was 13.
No point did I ever have a fear of being shot ever. And this was the experience of Zakaria growing up, along with, again, like I always want to reference, make it clear that this is like not a unique story, right? Everything that we're talking about, this early life that I'm talking about, is not unique to Zakaria. It's not unique to any Palestinian, especially the ones in Jenin. So because we can only imagine, because of this, early experience with the occupation, his resistance only really grew stronger. So by the age that he was 15 years old, he was arrested. And oh wait, actually, sorry, I missed that. 14 years old, he was arrested for the first time for throwing stones, and he was actually jailed for 6 months. So 13, he was shot in the leg for throwing stones. At 14, he was arrested and thrown into jail for 6 months for throwing stones. And even within they added this part, when he was 14 years old and in the prison, he was described as a leader representing other child prisoners to the as within the prison, which is just so sad to think about at 14 to do that. But by the time he was 15, he was actually arrested again. And this time he was arrested for throwing Molotov cocktails, and he was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison. And what's interesting is this time when he was in prison, he actually decided to learn Hebrew, and he became very politically active. And he became politically aligned with Fatah. The main thing that I wanted to point out here is that just by the age of 15, the occupation had already defined his life, his outcome. Everything about him was defined by the occupation. So then we go into like this the second part of his life, where the Second Intifada. So after being released from prison after 4.5 years, we have in the early 2000s, obviously the Second Intifada happened. And he was actually a leading figure in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and he decided to take up arms. And I really want to emphasize this part, because it wasn't out of choice, but out of necessity in his eyes, in anyone living under occupation's eyes. It was a response to the relentless attack on his people. So under his command, the brigades carried out operations against the Israeli military and settler targets. And he was actually described to be one of Israel's most wanted men at just nine and at just 19 years old. They During the Second Intifada, his mother was unalived, or sorry, killed in a Israeli raid. And
Cut off.
this is like a very clear act of collective punishment. They targeted his home, they demolished his home, and killed his mother just at the age of 19 years old. And as we know, this is a very frequent tactic. We all know about the collective punishment and how they've been condemned internationally for this tactic. They've been condemned internationally for their belligerent occupation. But there it is, and it still remains, and it affects the lives of people like Zakaria every single day. So I feel like it's so important to really focus on that part, to focus on the fact that this one person. This one person, how many different things affected him and shaped his life for him to become the person that he was. Now, during this time, I wanted to actually quote him when he d during the Second Intifada, and this is what he said. He said, "From midnight until morning, I prepare for death. I don't sleep at night. I don't sleep at all. I wait for death." A 19-year-old kid. Essentially, like 19. At 19, this is his life.
That's a baby.
That's a baby. That's a child. You're at night. You're 19 years old. This is your reality. This is all you've known. This is your entire life. You've just been faced with an occupation that is set out to erase you. And again, now this next part, it's gonna be. I really want everyone to pay attention to this part, because.
We're listening.
So now I want to talk about the shift that happened in the early 2000s for Zakaria. Essentially, I want to talk about his shift to cultural resistance, where Zubeida tried to put down his he actually did. He did put down his arms, and Israel actually offered him amnesty, and along with other fighters, in exchange for their demobilization. Instead of resistance through arms, he turned to cultural resistance, educational resistance, and actually founded the famous Freedom Theater in Jenin to empower the young Palestinian youth through arts. Now, His journey with the cultural resistance did begin a bit earlier in the 1990s with the Arna's House Project. So this was actually led by an Israeli activist named Arna Meir Chamis. The initiative sought to foster a quote-unquote understanding between the Israelis and the Palestinians through the theater and through education. There was Israeli volunteers who participated, including Zakaria's mother, Samira, who was believing in the possibility of peace and actually opened the top floor of their family home for rehearsals. Now, Zakaria, who was just 12 years old at the time, along with his older brother Dawood and four other boys, became the core troupe for this I guess theater at the time. However, despite this entire family's efforts towards coexistence, tragedy struck, and during the Second Intifada, they still killed his mother. We talked about that a little bit earlier as well, where, and there's this part right here where you see Zakaria actually reflecting on the betrayal, where he said, this was later on, he said, "You took our house and our mother, and you killed our brother. We gave you everything. And what did we get in return? A bullet in my mother's chest. We opened our home and you demolished it. Every week, 20 to 30 Israelis would come and do theater in there. We fed them, and afterward, not one of them picked up the phone. That is when I saw the real face of the left in Israel." So, like this quote specifically, and it's something that I talk about all the time. It's essentially how you have this like facade of like the Israeli left and how they want coexistence and peace and blah 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 with the Palestinian people, but they're not actually willing to do anything to change the status quo, right? As if a theater is going to change the reality of living under a belligerent occupation, right? It's not something that was, going to help them, but at the age of 12, being introduced to it and actually trying. His family clearly tried, he tried, and it did nothing. And if that's not more proof of how fake the Israeli left is, of how much of a facade it is, how it doesn't even exist, right? I don't know what else is, because if he could recognize it at an early age, who are we to negate it? Now there's this other part right here where he talks about not wanting to even become a resistance fighter. So he basically said, and this was right when he decided to, put down his resistance and actually participate in this agreement with the Israelis to put down his arms, where he said, "I didn't want to become an armed resistance fighter, but this is what life gave me. I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be Romeo. Now at the Freedom Theater, others can have that chance." So he actually founded this theater to be an actual beacon of light for the Palestinian youth and try to actually guide them into a form of resistance through culture. Now I th th this is a part that I really wanted to make clear, because clearly he had goals, he had wants and everything in his life to become something, the way every single one of us. Like, I wanted to be an astronaut growing up, and clear that didn't happen, but if I wanted to become an astronaut, I would have had the opportunity to. Now, I always say, like, I wish I could say that they all had lives before all of this, but they didn't, right? They were born into a belligerent occupation. As Zakaria himself said, they had dreams and they had aspirations, just like anyone else. But those dreams were stolen before they could even take shape. The occupation had decided their fate before they even had a chance to think them up. The occupation decided everything for them. And the biggest thing, this is like the part that I really want people to understand, is that the occupation is what builds this resistance, and you know, we can't
We
be.
are a result of the occupation.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't have said it better, and I'm freaking glad you said that because,
I love you.
thank you.
Thank
Now,
you. I love you is crazy, actually. What the
oh,
hell?
did you say I love, girl? I'm
Oh
like
my God, I said
freaking.
I love you.
Oh
Yeah.
my God, I love you. I'm actually biting my lip. I just got
Oh my
nervous.
God. Okay, sorry, continue.
Oh my days.
Oh
Did
my
I actually say
days.
thank you? Wait, did I actually say thank you
Yeah,
when you
you
said that?
did.
That is so sickening. Oh my God, I'm gonna throw up. Anyways, now, as I just talked about how he attempted to found this theater, this freedom theater, where he put down his arm, he signed this agreement with Israel, for amnesty, and in the end, this is what happened. Essentially, Israel never let him go. In 2011, Israel actually decided to revoke his amnesty without any explanation, and he was repeatedly harassed, and then he was arrested in 2012. He was targeted, his brother was targeted, and he was thrown in jail. Which this was the part that I wanted to highlight as well, is that, you know, even those who chose quote unquote peace are still not free. Like, even though he put down his arms, even though he tried to do everything in his power to, you know, try to resist in a quote unquote peaceful way, it didn't work for him. And he was thrown in prison in 2012 up until the big, the great escape story that we all are aware of, where he decided to, you know, break out of prison with a spoon. So this was like one, like I'm pretty sure every single Palestinian is aware of this, like freaking very iconic moment in history. And I still smile thinking about it. I think everyone does. Where essentially, yeah, he. Oh my God, sorry. Where he completely like defied every single reality at that time and like escaped from prison. But unfortunately, it was a short-lived victory when he got out of prison, because they found him, recaptured him, and he was brutally beaten and placed in solitary confinement. So he still is, or at the time he was thrown in prison from 2021 again up until today, where he was released inside of the exchange deal, which was, you know, the present day right now, which was like it was very heartwarming for the average person who is aware of his story, that now he was finally a, I don't want to say he's a free man, but he is free again. And with this, I don't know. One thing that I always think about in his regard is the fact that, you know, he wanted to be a person of art, a person that, you know, he was very involved in theater. He was a person who wanted to become an actor. He wanted to be a Romeo, growing up. And it's kind of like iconic that now that he's out of prison, you know, he'll probably be able to see how he, you know, was a beacon of resistance, and like he was a symbol of resistance to literally like millions of people across the globe. Like, he touched, like,
You know,
if you go,
sorry, no, because I was gonna say, like, you know that he, so during when he was in prison, right? So he was in prison with one of his close friends, like Waleed Abu Da'a, or Waleed Da'a. Did you talk about his daughter's birthday?
No, I
So
didn't.
okay, so Waleed passed away. Waleed was martyred by the occupation through like medical negligence, which we'll most likely talk about in a future episode. But during when Zakaria was in solitary confinement, he submitted an urgent request to the occupation and to like the administration in December of was it 2022 or 2021, I believe. 2022, I think. To donate his bone marrow, so like Zakaria's bone marrow, to Waleed Da'a, who was battling cancer. And as well as not only just battling cancer, brutally like battling the Zionist like prison, and the whatever horrible treatment that they get there. And so his daughter Milad, which we know means birth, celebrated her 5th birthday, I believe on February 3 or 2, and so he, but she was also, by the way, like, she was also born through like smuggled sperm, which is so cool. We should talk about
Oh
that.
my gosh.
But he's like, there's like a video of him like singing to her, like after his release, and he's like, you know, happy birthday to you, and he's like, I wish you a happy year. I wish you a happy year, Milad, Palestine is free, Milad.
Oh
So
my
cute.
freaking God.
Yeah. And Zakaria, sorry, he also lost his son. The Israeli occupation forces actually did an airstrike in Jenin in 2024, and they killed his son while he was in prison too. So his story is one of, the saddest. He lost his mom at a young age. He tried to come to peace with Israelis, with the left. His mom even tried. They welcomed them into their houses, and it was gone. He tried peaceful. It didn't help. And he's continued, like what Hiba was saying, he continued to be a better person and wanting to help his friend. And when he was released
Like
in
while he was
January.
in solitary confinement, like, can you imagine?
Yeah, very, very like heartless of him, or not, sorry,
No.
it's the one I'm
Heartful, selfless, selfless, selfless.
selfless. Sorry, y'all, I am past my bedtime. Very selfless of him to even think about that while he's in solitary confinement.
Yeah. Is there anything else you
Wow.
want to add, Lanush?
No, that's pretty much it. That
All right.
he is a big symbol inside of every family's home. Yeah.
All right, so bear with me, y'all. I'm going to be talking about Khalida Gerard, who is like no ordinary figure in Palestinian politics. She's been arrested multiple times. She's been subjected to torture, solitary confinement, all this because she fights tirelessly for Palestinian rights and challenges Israel's narrative on the global stage. She's a feminist, academic, political leader, and a steadfast resistor who whose stance has made her target of unrelentless like persecution. So she this is something she said in prison, from prison. She says, "I stand tall and steadfast despite the shackles and the jailer." So I really hope I do her justice. She's one of my, genuinely one of my, I don't want to say icon because icon is so like corny, but I genuinely, yeah, I don't know, bro. I hope I do her justice. So she was born in Nablus in the Israeli occupied West Bank on February 9th, 1963. She was raised in a land that was already fractured by the occupation. Her formative years were shaped by Israel's military rule, daily indignities, and like the currents of Palestinian resistance. She would later in her life recall how deeply these experiences informed her worldview and steeled her resolve to fight for justice. So, her dad was a toy shop maker, by the way, which is like really cool.
Oh my God, so cute.
It's so cute. So in 1985, she earned a master's degree in political science from Birzeit University. And her commitment to scholarship was never detached from like her on the ground like activism, right? So she also studied international law, human governance, human rights, and became the cornerstone of a life de and like she spent it defending prisoners, challenging administrative detention, and pushing for accountability at the ICC. She married Ghassan Jarrad, a fellow student and a political activist who overall has been arrested 14 times by Israeli forces, spending nearly 11 years in and out of administrative detention. They had 2 daughters, Yafa and Soha, raising them, and they, you know, their daughters would come and talk about how they were raised in a household braced for the constant threat of Israeli raids. And her and Khalida and Ghassan's like activism made them prime targets. And it also bound them together for a common purpose, which I think is beautiful. So her first arrest was or her first documented, at least from what I found, was on International Women's Day in 1989. So she participated in a demonstration to mark International Women's Day, and it would mark the first of many many years that she would spend in under Israeli detention. And it symbolized, right, like her intersectional stances, her feminism, her national liberation, and I think that's important. So in 1993, she after Israel and the PLO signed Oslo I, she served as the vice chairman for Adamir, which is the Palestinian political prisoners' rights group based in the West Bank. And she had previously worked for UNRWA. And at Adamir, she documented and publicized Israel's use of the indefinite detention, torture, violent harassment against Palestinian detainees. And she built like legal defenses and to challenge the occupation's policies. So in 98, Israel was barred. Oh my God, Israel barred Khaleda from traveling outside of occupied Palestine. And Tel Aviv took issue with her participation in a human rights defenders conference that was held in Paris, France. So they recognized Israel. Basically, what they did is they recognized her capacity to expose human rights violations in the international stage. So they genuinely like said, "Nope, you're not leaving ever again." So. She was a longtime member of my favorite faction of Palestine, of the Palestinian factions, which is the PFLP, which is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And she rose to become a deputy leader and member of its political bureau in 2006. And she was then elected to the Legislative Council. So, basically, so she held an official position in charge of the political prisoners file in the PLC, in the Palestinian Legislative Council. She additionally served as a member of the Supreme National Committee to follow up on the file of Palestine's accession to the ICC. Like this, oh, this is amazing. So like all this, and then she also like had a parliamentary seat, and she amplified calls to end administrative detention, advance prisoner rights legislation, and campaign to bring Israel war crimes before the ICC. And so in 2014 of August, her home was suddenly surrounded by at least 50 Israeli soldiers who broke down her doors, invaded her living space, like held her at gunpoint, and told her that she was served with a deportation order. They forced her in her home to flee from El Bira to Jericho, and she refused to leave her home. She literally says, "This is my home. I will not leave." Then in April of 2015, an administrative detention order was issued against her following a raid on her home that resulted in her arrest. In December of that same year, she was issued a 15-month sentence after being convicted, in the Israeli military court, which we already know the conviction rate, which is 99.7% conviction rate. She faced over a dozen charges: incitement, membership of an illegal organization, Amnesty International, including the New York Times, including all these like human rights as well as like highly regarded publishing like wheelhouses have all looked into her cases, and they're like, yeah, no, Israel bullshitted. Israel's like quite literally is making these up out of nowhere. And most like Amnesty specifically, they said that they recognized it as a political punishment for her ICC advocacy, which is crazy, you
Oh
know?
my gosh.
So, from So, you know, so she was arrested in April 2015. She was released in June of 2016. She served 15 months. In the summer of 2017, she was rearrested and held in administrative detention until early 2019. And in 2019, she was arrested again, and was freed. She was arrested for 2 years and was freed in September 2021. And each time she refused to dilute her activism or her political stances. The repeated arrests just highlight like how Israel uses administrative detention to keep Palestinian leaders like her locked away indefinitely, without formal charges or a trial. And so within her detention, like within her treatment, she suffered like multiple ICE Okay, ischemic infarctions and hypercholesterol. Oh my God, cholesterol. Can you help me out? Cholesterolemia. I don't know this word. It's my first time speaking.
Ischemic. The first
Ischemic.
one was ischemic.
Ischemic. Yeah, I'm not listening. This is why I'm not in the medical stuff. And I'm
Please.
gonna. It's hypercholesterolemia. She was hospitalized for Asbestexis. Oh my God, this is what I have, the severe nosebleeds.
Oh, wow. Haram.
And obviously prison authorities neglected her health needs. And so she's not pleading, she wasn't pleading for her freedom in prison. She was actively like actually keeping herself busy educating fellow prisoners about international law. A really, really cool thing is that she led classes in Hasharon prison. She, like I said, she like educated over 30 women prisoners, including some of the minor girls held in Hasharon prison, and participated in the classes. She exemplifies, like, she taught them about international human rights law, which is so like interesting to me.
I love that so much.
Like, you know how they call these is the, like there's a thing that they call the Israeli occupation prisons, and it's called like the Schools for Revolution, which is so interesting to me. But so this is I'm gonna be so while in prison, she was denied to see to make final goodbyes to several people. One, the first was her father. And it was her father and her nephew all died when she was in prison. But the greatest heartbreak, I believe, was her daughter in 2021. Her daughter Soha passed away while she was in prison. She, yeah. So, her daughter was found out in near her home in Ramallah, and they would not,
Alhamdulillah.
Allah yarhamha, and they, so many or like this. Caused like a global outcry, and the Israeli pol like the Israeli military would not release her to go visit her daughter. I'm gonna read something that she wrote to her daughter while in prison. She said, "I'm in so much pain, my child, only because I miss you. I'm in so much pain, my child, only because I miss you. From the depths of my agony, I reached out and embraced the sky of our homeland through the window of my prison cell in Damon Prison, Haifa. Worry not, my child. I stand tall and steadfast despite the shackles and the jailer. I am a mother in sorrow from yearning to see you one last time. This doesn't happen except in Palestine. All I wanted to do was bid my daughter a final farewell with a kiss on her forehead and to tell her I love her as much as I love Palestine. My daughter, forgive me for not attending the celebration of your life, that I was not beside you during this heartbreaking and final moment. My heart has reached the heights of the sky, yearning to see you, to caress and plant a kiss on your forehead through the small window of my prison cell. Soha, my precious, they have stripped me from bidding you a final goodbye kiss. I bid you farewell with a flower. Your absence is searingly painful, excruciatingly painful, but I remain steadfast and strong, like the mountains of beloved Palestine.
Wow.
Oh my.
I literally have goosebumps. That's so sad and so cute at the same
I
time.
know, I know. Soha, before her death, she wrote a powerful like thing about Palestinian detainees. She said that Palestinian women detainees represent all facets of the Palestinian society. They include parliamentarians, leaders, journalists, social workers, mothers, and healthcare service providers. Between 1967 to 2020, more than 10,000 Palestinian women were jailed by the Israeli authorities for their involvement in the Palestinian resistance. Mother and daughter alike, they both reflected each other's unwavering commitment to exposing Israel's treatment of Palestinian prison. When Khalida was finally released in September of 2021, the first thing she did was visit Soha's grave. There's videos of her, like, you know, bawling at the site at the grave, which is like honestly, yeah. So in a letter from 2020 from like the Damon prison, she explained that books do not t reach us at times as they undergo tight control mechanisms and confiscations. Depriving prisoners access to books is used as a punishment. We are transforming our detention into a cultural revolution through reading, education, and literary discussions. She said none of Gramsci's books were allowed into the prisons due to what seems to be a very hostile chance by the occupation authorities towards Gramsci. Yet your books here are arrested like our people are. In March, on March 8th, she wrote a on which was, you know, International Women's Day, she wrote from her prison cell, "To the glorified women of Palestine in the world, we receive March 8th at a time the whole of humanity is facing COVID-19 from one side and systems of oppression, racism, and colonialism from the other. A thousand greetings to the voices resisting this occupation, this oppression and subjugation. May women remain at the forefront of this resistance and March 8th as a symbol of liberation. My companions and sisters in Palestine, the Arab countries, and around the world, from my prison, I am sending my warmest greetings to you, as I am proud of you and your fight against all forms of injustice, persecution, and oppression. The status of women in Palestine and the Arab world has still not reached the acceptable minimum of fairness, justice, and equality." She emphasized the feminist struggles are inseparable from anti-colonial struggles and said that this is represented by the oppression of the Zionists and their occupation of our homeland, Palestine. So literally, we're going to fast forward a little bit because she was released. And then really interestingly enough, she was about to speak on a panel, an international panel about a resistance and especially like administrative detention, i.e. torture in Israeli prisons during a genocide. 2 days, on December 28th, 2023. Then on December 26th, 2023, they arrested her. So, literally, she was arrested from her home by Israeli soldiers and placed under administrative detention. She has been subjugated to torture at the hands of the Israeli forces. And we know she's one of the women and people of the West Bank who, like, you know, they, like, pick them up and they just quite literally charge them on nothing. And people are still being held to this day. And this is... she spent 100 days or 6 months in solitary confinement. She was placed in a 2-meter by 1.5-meter cell with no ventilation, where the only available space is occupied by a mattress. The cell is completely closed with no windows for ventilation or for fresh air. She's described it herself as, "I die every day. The cell is like a small closed box with where no air enters. There's only a toilet in the cell with a small window above it, which was later sealed just one day after my transfer. They left me no space to breathe. I'm suffocating in my cell, waiting for the hours to pass, hoping to find some oxygen particles to breathe and stay alive. They have deliberately cut off water in the cell. Even when I request to fill a water bottle to drink, they bring it in at least 4 hours. I am, in short, inside an oven at its highest setting."
Oh my goodness.
Right. Human rights groups have called this a life-threatening campaign of systemic repression, systematic repression aimed at breaking her will. So, during the negotiations for a ceasefire, Hamas demanded her freedom. They insisted that Jarrah be included in the swap deal, recognizing her they recognize her significance as a symbol of Palestinian like steadfastness and resistance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on January 19th, we saw her exiting the bus, and we saw the way that she we saw what she looked like and what they tried to do to her, the state of her. And the first thing that she did as soon as she came out of the bus was raise her fist, which was so beautiful. And it was a gesture of defiance, even months in an airless cell where they quite literally were suffocating her. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you guys have read Franz Kafka. I have. I love him. But so basically, multiple testimonies of her trials refer it to the book, to like Franz Kafka's The Trial. So like basically one of... a policeman once testified that an alleged witness had identified her in a photo lineup consisting of 6 men and only 1 woman, her.
Mm.
So this witness, right?
Mm.
So they brought a photo, like this is what her husband has said. Hassan has said, "They brought photos of men, one with a mustache, one bald, another with a long beard, and then a photo of my wife. Who do you think he singled out? It's a charade."
Obviously, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The court extended her detention using quote-unquote secret files that neither she or her lawyers could see. The legal farce of this all, like, underscored the moral bankruptcy of the Israeli military system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, I'm confused about this picture thing.
What do you mean? So you know when a witness is, like, there's a witness that comes out and says, "Oh, I saw blank committing blank crime." Right. They provided this quote unquote witness with like photos of like, oh, who do you like, who is the person that you saw
Oh
during
my
this thing?
God.
And it was like, obviously they knew it was a woman, and they brought up a
Right.
lineup of like five
Other
different men
men.
and then one woman. So who do you think the witness picked out?
Right. Oh my goodness. Okay, sorry. I needed to like comprehend that a little bit. Like I thought that's what you were saying, but then I
Yeah,
was
no,
like,
literally, right? And like many,
what?
like I said, it's insane. Like many other, like there's been investigations into like how, what, like her crimes and her charges and like her quote unquote crimes, alleged crimes, no crimes actually. Like her only crime is being Palestinian and an educated woman, but whatever.
Right.
All of that, and like they've all saw, like have, like been able to see that it's quite literally like a charade, like her husband said. So, and so her name, Khalida, it means immortal, right? And it reflects enduring, her, like it reflects her, right? And she weaponizes international law and political science knowledge, building cases at the ICC and champions like detainees' rights. She's specifically like what I like, honestly, I'm in such awe of, and I don't know what other word to describe it. I love her so much for this. And she like ties the woman liberation to national liberation. And she rejects like surface approaches that ignore colonial oppressions. She
That's
embodies the
amazing.
intimate pain of losing her daughter while imprisoned, her father, her nephew. And she like her in prison alone, she taught about human rights, smuggling in banned books. She like quite like I said, she coined like her time in jail was coined as schools for revolution. And she like throughout her letters, she like says that she insisted about her daughter. She's like, all I wanted was to bid my daughter a final farewell, but I remained steadfast and strong like the mountains of beloved Palestine. And
How did her daughter pass away,
I
or
looked
was she
into it. It was
killed?
no, she. It, they said heart attack, and then also I've also like seen
Haram.
things that it was for an unknown reason, and I looked it up and I can't find anything further. But her daughter was like, honestly, like her daughter, like Soha, was like, let me find it 1 second. She is such a like, she like does so much work outside of her mother, right? She has like she started a new job in environmental law. She starts at like she works at like NGOs, like local NGOs. She let me find more. I'm sorry, I have so much more. I just need to like, we
No,
just
you're
love
fine. I
educated
feel like
women.
this, yeah, and I feel like this is important when we talk about
Of course.
resistance, right? Because us Palestinians, we always say resistance isn't just picking up, a gun or doing
Right.
whatever.
Right.
She is like the symbol of resistance that they fear, the resistance of being smart, educated, being able to talk, and the ICC and the ICJ, and being able to threaten them in such a way terrifies them more than us being armed resistance.
Literally. And so her daughter was a she, Al-Haq, the
Human rights organization.
yeah, so his daughter, her daughter was a researcher and an advocacy officer at Al-Haq. She was a gender and environmental policy researcher, as well in the legal research and advocacy department, and she worked with dedication there. And yeah, so I just think it's so heartbreaking. She, her and her mother, and like they're yeah, they're both of their strive for advocacy, education, and all of that. Allah yirhamha. Yeah, and so the first, like, so from like for Khalida, right? The first moment she was arrested in 1989 on International Women's Day to her repeated incarcerations and her final solitary confinement, Khalida proved that has proven impossible to silence, right? We know she's lost already so much, and her liberation in January of 2025, it capped years of relentless oppression. And she stepped off the prison bus, like I said, with a raised fist, and reminding Palestinians and the world that Samud cannot be broken by steel bars or locked cells. And she remains a feminist academic who taught human rights inside prison, a defender of Palestinian detainees who carried the cause to the ICC, a mother who wrote beautiful letters to her daughter, an icon of in the broader liberation struggle. Her words and those of Soha serve as an eternal testament to the unbreakable human will, affirming that no matter how many times the occupation tries to bury her voice, it'll inevitably be heard. And I think, yeah, I genuinely hope I did her
That
justice.
was the
That was
most
amazing.
like it was so captivating to hear that entire story. My mic cut out for a little bit, but when you read
Oh,
the
okay.
quote about her in
Her
like
daughter.
her first
So,
reaction
yeah.
to her daughter dying, like dying and her not even being able to bid her farewell, like that was like I tried to speak and I literally
I'm
couldn't, but
sorry.
it no, it was not your fault, it was mine. But I was like, oh my God, like that was, and I'm gonna keep on thinking about that
Yeah,
till,
she,
yeah, because
there's
it's how
this,
much was taken from someone.
right. This is like one person in the micro. There's a book I'm gonna recommend to everybody. It was released in 2020, and it's These Chains Will Be Broken, and it's Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons, written by Ramzi Barood. And she writes the foreword in here. And like I'll like summarize I'll summarize a little bit from the foreword of what she says here. And she says, 1 second, let me just, like, because I have the book pulled up. The PDF is accessible, everybody. So if you know what that means, you know what that means. she says, let me find it. In prison, we must become aware of time because if we do not, it will stand still. So we do everything we can to fight the routine, to take every opportunity to celebrate and to commemorate every important occasion in our lives, personal or collective. The stories in this book are not written to shock you, but rather to illustrate even a small part of the daily reality endured by thousands of men and women who are still confined within high walls, barbed wire, and metal doors. When you read this book, you will have a frame of reference that will enable you to imagine now and always what life in Israeli prison looks like. It says, she says, in every story, whether included in this book or not, is not a fleeting experience that only concerns the person who's lived it, but an event that shakes to the very core the prisoner, her comrades, her family, and her entire community. Each story represents a creative interpretation of a life lived despite all the hardship by a person whose heart beats with the love of her homeland and the longing of her precious freedom. Each individual narrative is also a defining moment, a conflict between the will of the prison guard and all that he represents, and the will of the prisoners and what they represent as a collective. In actuality, these are not just prison stories. For Palestinians, the prison is a microcosm of the much larger struggle of a people who refuse to be enslaved on their own land, who are determined to regain their freedom with the same will and vigor carried by all triumphant once colonized nations. The sufferings and the human rights violations experienced by Palestinian prisoners, which run contrary to international humanitarian law, are only one side of the prison story. This book will allow you to live part of the experience by briefly touching the inspiring human trajectory of Palestinian women and men who have subsisted through defining moments with all their painful details and challenges.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
Yeah. And then like the other part of it is like the flip side of, okay, so she lost so much and then how much like her community, her family lost from her being
Yeah.
in prison. And I think that's like the other goal of the occupation is to take these leaders, these revolutionaries within our societies and, you know, contain
Break
them
the
to a cell and break their spirit.
Yeah. And not just them, it's collective punishment. Like you said, it doesn't just affect a person in prison. It affects their family members, their society, their people, our revolution. And I truly hope we did the three hostages justice. So
Genuinely,
thank God
yeah.
for their freedom. I hope they continue becoming resilient. Nael al-Barghouti, Zakaria Zbadi, and Khalida, they have all gone through so much. They have all lost, their houses have all been demolished. They have all lost family members while being in prison, and they were all tortured. And when you see them out of prison, it's very bittersweet, and it's very important to remember that the release of our Palestinian hostages, it's not just a moment of personal triumph, but it's also a powerful reminder of our ongoing struggles for justice and dignity. That's all Palestinians want. Some have returned to their families, some haven't. Some are actually in exile and can't even unite with their families. We still have more than 10,000 hostages remaining in Israeli prisons. The fight for their freedom, the fight for a free Palestine continues, and it's always going to be driven by the resilience and unwavering spirit of those who refuse to be forgotten. We all as a collective need to continue fighting for their release and work towards ending the belligerent occupation that has caused so much suffering, not only for the three people we spoke about, for the thousands who are still in prison, like Ahmed Manasra, like Dr. Abu Sufia, who was kidnapped, like Khalil Al-Awda, who was kidnapped in 2022. He's actually in administrative detention and has been on a hunger strike for more than 160 days to try and end the detention. This is just, the top of the top. We could talk for ages about every single one of our hostage, alive and dead. So I hope we did them justice. And to end the episode, like always, we're going to talk about someone from Humanize Gaza. Humanize Gaza is something we all created here when we would see our Palestinian people, whether it's in Palestine, West Bank, or Gaza, and in Lebanon, being martyred and them just being called a number. We wanted to make sure their names are always remembered, their stories are always remembered, and they're not just a body and a number. These people had lives that they lived for, they had family, they had everything, and it was taken away. I think it's fitting to talk about Iyad Al-Rantisi for this episode. He was only 53 years old. His martyr date was November 16th of 2023. Iyad was an amazing father, husband, and he was a doctor. He was actually the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in the maternity department. He tried to help relentlessly all throughout the genocide, and he tried to make sure that his community and his people had care in one of the few hospitals in North Gaza. On November 10th, Iyad was actually kidnapped by the Zionist entity from the safe route in Gaza. He was trying to evacuate to the south with his family and to try and help the people in the south who needed medical care, specifically maternity care. So while he was going to the south on Salah ad-Din, the safe route, he was stopped, him and his family. His daughter, who's only 19 years old, her name is Dina Al-Rantisi. She recounts the final moment she saw him alive. She states, "I was next to him. I could not move my hands. I couldn't hold him. I couldn't do anything. The occupation forces had ordered us to walk without looking left or right. We had to leave him." Iyad was randomly picked out of the crowd and then taken away. For the next 7 months, his family continued searching for him and continued the hope that he was alive, and they just, had him imprisoned. They were wondering if the Zionist entity released him, and again, they just continued the hope. Unfortunately, in June of 2024, his family finally got word back that Iyad was brutally tortured in prison and had become a martyr only 6 days after he was kidnapped. So they continued the hope for almost a year, but he was killed 6 days into the prison. Dr. Iyad's death was one of the first reported by Haaretz on June 18th of 2024. According to Haaretz, he died at an interrogation facility run by the Shin Bet, Israel Internal Intelligence Agency, only 6 days after his arrest on November 10th. They have continued to keep his body and they will not release it. Dina writes, "My father was not an ordinary person." Dina's also a university student, so very amazing family. She continues to say, "He cared about me since my childhood and would always call me Dr. Dina. He always encouraged me to excel in my studies and pursue postgraduate studies. All I want is my father's body. I want to say goodbye to him. I want to see him. I miss him so much. I ask the international community and global organizations not to forget the prisoners, especially the ones who are doctors. How can a doctor go from carrying out a humanitarian mission to then being detained and then killed brutally?" So, just remember, our Palestinian hostages are being tortured as we speak. It's very bittersweet seeing our hostages being released every week. Hopefully, the ceasefire continues and we can continue seeing our Palestinian hostages come out. But just do not forget that there are thousands left, children, women, men, who are there just because they resisted, whether it's by their
Actually,
intelligence.
I'm gonna cut you off actually because as of yesterday, and here we'll say glory to the resistance because as of yesterday, after yesterday's release, there are officially they released 44 children and women, and officially there are no Palestinian women or child prisoners left in Israeli prisons. So glory to the resistance
Gaza,
in
yeah,
Gaza.
that in Gaza,
Yep,
alhamdulillah. Yeah,
glory to
these
the
people,
resistance.
genuinely glory to
Alhamdulillah.
the resistance, whether it's Hamas, whether it's PFLP, whether it's Hezbollah, like we would
Whether it's
never have
Khalida,
seen,
whether it's
whether
Khalida.
it's Khalida, yeah, we would have never seen this in front of our eyes. We wouldn't have seen Nael, who is the longest prisoner, come out. We wouldn't have seen Khalida, unfortunately, come out too late, or Zakaria Zbedi, who truly wanted peace and who tried to work for it. So inshallah, we continue seeing it. Thank you, everyone, for sticking around with us and listening to it. And thank you, Hiba and Lina. Always a pleasure. You guys did a fantastic job. This was an
Thank
amazing
you.
episode. We
Thank
love you.
you. Thank you guys
This
for listening
was.
and see you guys next week.
Thank you. Bye,
Bye.
guys.